Accession number 18207, Real One.
Tom O'Reilly, Real One, where were you born, please?
Birkenhead.
Which year was this?
1923.
You grew up and have your schooling in Birkenhead?
Yep, yes.
How old were you when you left school?
Well, I stayed on at that time. I think you could leave at, I'm thinking way back now, I think you could leave at the age of 14. But I think I was 16 plus when I left school, because I stayed on and in the sixth form, school captain and the like, and I was very sporty. So I think I thoroughly enjoyed my schooling.
Were you at a grammar school?
Yeah, St. Hugh's.
And so when you left school, had the war already started?
Yes, yes. Hang on. No, it hadn't. Sorry, it hadn't. I left school, let's see, I think the war started in 39, didn't it? 39. Was it September 39?
Yes.
You know, I think I was out for about maybe 12 months. It shows you how harebrained you get when you get on a bit. I'm just trying to think back. I'd be about 12 months, you know, I should imagine. Because my first job I obtained was through the boxing fraternity. One of our trainers, Tommy Murray, had a respectable job as a shipbuilder called Harland Wolf in Birkenhead. And he got me a position there as an apprentice marine engineer. And then the war started, I think, and then I volunteered from there. That's why I didn't stay in the marine engineering business.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yeah, yeah.
Under what circumstances did you hear it?
Well, at that time, I think I was more interested in girls than dancing. I think probably at home, a radio broadcast.
And how did you feel about it?
Well, I was pretty well unconcerned, I think, at that time. As I said, my priorities then weren't, they were very much down to earth. I think they were more on the training angle for boxing and chasing young women.
Were you in any of the early bombing of England by the German Air Force?
Oh, yes, yes. I can recall going to dances locally, and that's what kind of amused when you think about the way you stuck your neck out, really. We'd be going to dances, and there'd be a raid on, and we'd be making our way to a dance session or coming home, either way. And you'd hear the shrapnel zipping down all over the place, but I don't know whether you got used to it or you just got so blase about it that you just kind of kept to the wall out of the way, and you never thought of the possibility of getting hit in the nut with a piece of this shrapnel, but never seemed to worry us somehow. We were in a shelter at one time near the Park Station in Birkenhead, and a bomb hit the station itself and rattled all the side of the station. And apparently two shelters up, which is only about 25 yards away, one of the parachute bombs, a 10-tonner type of thing that Jerry was dropping at that time, landed on the roof of this thing. But as I say, you seem to be so unconcerned at that age, we just kind of came out at the end of the warning and just headed back home. And that was it, just another night finished kind of thing.
What was your address at this time?
In Harding Avenue, the north end of Birkenhead.
And did many bombs fall in round Harding Avenue?
Not so much in Birkenhead. Yeah, there was one. Yes, there was one in Goodwin Avenue. It dropped at the above. There were three rows of houses, three avenues, and the first one Harding, then followed by Goodwin, and we were on the second half of the row that was more or less tied on to the back end of the first row of Goodwin. And one of the houses in Goodwin land got walloped with a bomb that blew the windows out, but didn't do any structural damage to our house. You know.
Were any of your friends or relatives casualties in the bombing?
No, no.
Were you ever frightened at all?
Well, I don't think you realise the danger somehow. I can't recall being frightened at all at any time. But at the same time, not saying that you weren't near to it. I think we just didn't realise that the consequences.
How did public morale generally hold up on Merseyside?
Oh, it's pretty good. I mean, I don't think anybody even contemplated the thought of being defeated at all, or the possibility of invasions and the like. Well, at that particular time, certainly not.
What did people feel about the air crews who were carrying out the bombing?
I would think quite a bit of animosity, I would think. But to be perfectly frank, I never, at that time, I never even gave it a thought.
Now, how did you come to be in the RAF yourself?
Well, the glamour role at the start of the war was kind of, I can remember posters yelling out, "Book your seat for Berlin." And I think that kind of got to me. And I was sufficiently big-headed to think that I always wanted the top. In other words, I played a lot of football. I played for the town team, which to me was the kind of the top you could achieve. I boxed. I won the ABA Championship. That was the top business. I finished up Kennedy Prize winner at school, which was a prize donated from a father of a boy who had been killed in the First World War. And it was for the most popular boy in the school, and the boys actually voted. And with 700 pupils, that was quite an achievement. I won that. I was school captain for 18 months. So I was always after, I always kind of headed for the, you might call it the top of the tree. And for my thinking then, a fighter pilot was top of the tree. And I just had a crack at it, you know.
How did you go about it?
Well, the recruiting office in Liverpool, I can't quite recall, it was off Lime Street somewhere, just went over there and volunteered, and then we had to take an aptitude test for acceptance, and one didn't volunteer, one wasn't taken in as a pilot. You expressed a preference, but your initial intake was as potential aircrew. And you took an aptitude test, and providing you passed the aptitude test, then you were placed on deferred service until you were of age to go in the forces. That was 17 and a quarter, you know. And I actually went in, it wouldn't be in my logbook even. I went in when I was 17 and a quarter, as far as I can recall. You know.
Well, that sounds to be like the summer of 1940, maybe.
It would be, yeah, thereabouts, sure.
Or maybe the autumn.
No, a little earlier than that, I think, because I think, of course, yes, I went in actual 40. I think I first joined and took the colours in 1940, as trainee aircrew. And we went in initially as what we would term officially OUT pilots under training,
Where did you go to at first?
Down to London, St John's Wood, in London. The ACRC, I think, I don't know what number it was, I think it might have been number one ACRC in London, Aircrew Receiving Centre. And we'd done a bit of square bashing there in London.
Any incidents that happened to you there?
Well, not as far as socially, yes. I met a young lady, Olive Whittaker, and I was once adopted by a second London family, the Whittaker family, and it was my second home while I was down in London. And I got very involved with Olive, in fact, and almost unofficially we became engaged, you know. But Mr. and Mrs. Whittaker, they lived, I can still remember the address, 21 Wigginton Avenue, Wembley. And it's my second home, and it was great, you know, they were really great. Very made me very welcome, and there couldn't do enough for me. They had two other daughters, Jean and Aileen, both younger. Olive was the older daughter. And Olive and I got involved.
Yeah. And after St. John's Wood?
St. John's Wood, I went to an operational or a selected station, ITW, Initial Training Wing, which was at Finningley in Doncaster. That at that particular time was, I think it was a Hamden OTU, a bomber OTU. But we'd done this ITW there.
What happened to you there?
When we finished that, we finished up down at Brighton. I think we came back to London initially and then down to Brighton. And then from Brighton, and we were all posted overseas. We went from Brighton into Padgate. And Padgate, we embarked in Liverpool and finished up in South Africa. And I nearly missed my posting. Being Padgate, I was so close to being home, you see. It's only outside Warrington. And I used to nip out after duty, more or less, and make it back at home the following day. But I used to time my re-entry into the camp when the, what was it called? The Salvation Army. Women's Institute.
WVS.
Refreshment effort came up to the front gate, and a lot of bods poured out the front gate for stuff and sweets, cigarettes and tea and coffee and whatever, and back in the gate. And I used to time my re-entry with these characters coming in, so the SPs at the gate never bothered to check me whether I'd been out or in. And I remember doing this one morning going back, and as I was coming through the camp itself, I saw my flight all marching out towards the big hangars there with the kit bags on the shoulders, all being posted. And one of the lads yelled, you know, I'd almost missed my posting. So I had to go like the clappers back to, you know, the billet and grab my stuff. Meanwhile, he'd more or less shouted my name out. And I enjoyed my flight, but I very nearly missed my posting that way. And I'll always remember on the ladies on Padgate Station when we came out, we had the old pith helmets on the back, and the ladies were coming up and kissing us. I don't know, they thought we were going to go for a bathing or something, but they were all running out and kissing all the little lads, the fond farewell and all the rest of it. We took it, and it was very funny, you know, that's right. And we embarked for South Africa.
Anything that happened on the voyage?
Well, apart from sunburn and the like, and the unpleasantness thing. One particular time, we used to have mess decks down below with so many people, and you had one individual was allocated to collect the meals from the ship's galley and bring it back to your own kind of mess deck, which was a... It was, I think it was about probably the second deck down or the first deck down, and it was a long trestle table from the wall up to about here with seats either side, and that's where we ate. And I always remember in Freetown, of all places, when I was the mess orderly at that particular time, and I wrote this dumping great tray of... pig's trotters.
Tripe?
Hot tripe sliding around on this tin, bloody big tin plate. And the lads took one look at it, and everybody was that warm and hot they could hardly climb up the stairs. And when they saw this stuff on the table, I don't think any of them partook of it. It went back as it came. But most of them, I think it turned a delicate shade of green and shot up to the top deck. But although that's something I remember, is the hot tripe at Freetown.
Now, presumably you were going on the Empire training scheme.
Mm. Yes.
Mm. Can you tell me where you went to for that, please?
Well, we disembarked at Durban, and then we entrained from Durban up to a place called Lyttelton, which was in Pretoria, or in the Transvaal, near Pretoria. And I think it was about 4,000 or 5,000 above sea level, something like that. And for the first week, I think it was a week, we were just informed just to take it easy and kind of lie back in your bunk and not do anything strenuous, more or less to acclimatise, because I can recall that we just didn't feel sufficiently energetic to do anything. And I think that we were at Lyttelton for about, I don't know, a week, 10 days before we actually were called to start any training.
Was that at Lyttelton?
Lyttelton, yeah.
Was the Pretoria area a good area to do RAF training in?
Oh, yeah. It was pretty flat. It was very flat, and the Transvaal itself was fairly elevated, I would think. Johannesburg, Pretoria and the like was, I think it was about, I'm just taking a wild guess, I think it was about 4,000 or 5,000 feet above sea level. And I know one had to become acclimatized when you first arrived there, you know.
Was the training done by South Africans or English people?
Amalgamation of both. Initially, while we were at Lyttelton, we'd done the two courses of training. One was what they call the initial training wing, which is all theoretical stuff, and the advanced training wing, ATW, which again was all theoretical. And that was all done at Lyttelton itself. From there, then, we went to a place called Vonderboom, an aerodrome.
Vonderboom?
Vonderboom, yes. There was a tree there, one of these historic things, I don't know, about 8 foot diameter, thumping great big effort. It was, and the place was named after this tree. Vonderboom won the tree, I think. I think that's the interpretation, I'm not sure.
I think it means of the tree in Dutch.
Or something like that, yeah. I know it was related to the tree. Well, we started our flying there, EFTS, on tiger moths.
What was the quality of instruction?
Pretty good. It was all, I had a South African, I'm just trying to think now, yes, all the instructors were South African Air Force, except, I think the CFI, the chief flying instructor, was RAF. We flew tiger moths then, and we had a combination of both flying and ground training. And right throughout this, you had progress tests, more or less every week. And you had to keep on top of them all the time, you know, so you weren't allowed to forget anything because you were tested on, say, a week's training, a fortnight's training, and so on. You kept a progressive test. Your test went alongside your training.
How did you get on with flying?
Oh, no bother. I'm not sure. I don't know what my first... Oh, sorry. I was just going to have a look, see, about something like 12 hours, dual or something like that, before I went solo, my first solo. Quite a big thing, you know, you're really, your flying instructor considers that you're ready for solo, then one of the OCs of the flight, who was a more senior officer, came and he took you for a type of a small test, and then if he agreed with the flying instructor's opinion, you landed, he just jumped out of the cockpit, removed the joystick, held it in hand, more or less, you're on your tod, and jumped out and waved you off. So you were off for your first solo. And quite an achievement, you know. Something that you remembered.
Did you have much to do with local civilians?
I got involved, yeah. Yeah, I did, yeah. At the EFTS, my initial training, I didn't have an awful lot to do with them. I had a particular pal. As you know, you always seem to team up with a particular individual in the forces, you know. And the lad I chased, there was a big lad from Ongar in Essex, Roy Wise. I've tried to contact Roy or tried to establish contact, but I'm unable to do that. Whether Roy's dead or alive, I don't know. I haven't got a clue. But Roy and I, we always used to do things together. And my eldest brother, who used to be a drummer before the war, and when he was called up initially, I took over from him and I played the drums for a little while. Well, when we were at EFTS, there was also on the course was a very accomplished pianist. I'm just trying to think. I think there was a saxophone player or something like that. We made a little kind of group between us. And we used to play at the odd functions that we had. And we used to be the band for the station, not the station, but for our particular flight. And I know when we had our farewell do at the end of the training, we performed, and of course everybody got absolutely blotto. And now that would be a recording and a half if you could have a recording of what it sounded like. It must have sounded absolutely shocking.
Were local civilians friendly, or did you ever come across unfriendly?
We had something that when we were first disembarked and went up to Lyttelton, the one who met us was a South African warrant officer, a big heavy lad, and he was an ex heavyweight boxer. So I was of particular interest with him, and in turn, he and me. Now, he told us initially, and he advised us, whatever you do, don't go out on your own. If you're out, keep to the main roads, don't divert, and so forth. And we wondered what this was all about, and he explained to us it was a group called the Ossawa Bromwicks. And the Ossawa Bromwicks were anti-British and very pro-German. And the difficulty was that one couldn't tell them from the pro-British. They were both identical. And they used to jump on quite a few of the RAF boys who were finished up in Roberts Heights Military Hospital as a result of these OBs. And I'll always remember this WO telling us to always go out in minimum of pairs, keep together, keep to the main roads, the main streets, the streets that were well illuminated, and not go off onto the others. And heading back to camp, if you saw any cars approaching, you'd get off the road, because a couple of lads used to, the OB wallers, if they were, they had knocked a couple of the boys off the side of the road, just swung into them as they passed them and hit them before. They only finished up in Roberts Heights with broken arms and legs and God knows what. Well, these were the OBs, and there was quite a few riots in South Africa the same way. I know we heard of, I'm not sure whether it was in a place called Vereeniging, a bomber. Some of the local army lads had come against these OBs at the university and had made had a mini riot about it, you know, and they'd really gone to town on the OBs. Ossawa Bromwicks, they call them. And later in my training, when we'd have the various lectures from the various officers, especially on the I'm getting that all now. I keep forgetting the how you would what would you say when you went through a letter and deleted censor. When we have a lecture on the censorship, we were told about various instances that these officers had come across, whereas these OBs had actually been in the forces themselves and had written back to the parents and how pleased they were with what they'd done, you know, the various types of espionage that they'd been able to carry out, you know. So it was quite a deal with these OBs.
Did you ever
unpleasant characters.
Did you ever have any trouble yourself?
Yeah, the first time I was put on the floor. I had a proud reputation of I'd never been put on the deck during my boxing career up to then. And we were at Vonderboom. We'd come out into town, and where our bus went from was by a cafe, and right on the corner of the road. Opposite was a rather high building that went on towards a square, and we used to come back and segregate by this cafe for the bus. And I can remember this particular instance coming past with a colleague of mine, and we were halfway across the road, and I could feel somebody pull me round. The next minute, something else exploded on my chin. And I finished up being helped back onto the pavement by my friend. I didn't know what had happened. And this character, we passed a bunch of blokes, civvies, on the corner as we went past them. And one of these characters apparently run after me and turn around and let me have one, well and truly. And it's the first time I've ever been put on the floor, you see, which upset me rather, because it broke my record. So I asked him who it was, kind of thing. He said, one of those characters over there. Meanwhile, there was a woman out in the services with the South African Air Force people. What, I don't know what they call them, WAFs. They wouldn't call them WAFs, but the equivalent to a WAF. They'd seen it and come across, and a couple of South African Air Force boys had seen it. And we more or less had, at that time, a gathering of servicemen was equal to the number that were opposite these civilians. And I went back across and asked who it was. They kind of thumped me, and one of these guys said it was my mate, and he'd do it again type of thing. Well, I immediately got stuck into him, and we had quite a bit of a fisticuff. Well, not much of a one, because he wasn't very good. And he finished up on the side of the road where I put him, and I was waiting for him to come back in so I could give him some further punishment. And an officer come up and broke it up. He said, disappear, you know, Scarpa. Said, if the police come, said, half the time some of the police are obese. Also, Abramovich, you know, said, so play it down, go back in the cafe, forget about it, lads, and finish it off, which we did. But these characters hung about all the time, I presume, waiting for me to come out on my Todd, but I never did, because all these, our lads had come back by then, and there was quite a few of us.
What was the name of this place where this occurred?
In Pretoria.
Which part of Pretoria?
In the town of Pretoria itself, you know. That's the name of the town, Pretoria. And Vonderboom was just outside of Pretoria, so we used to have a bus from the camp taking us down into South Africa itself, into Pretoria itself.
But you don't know the name of the street?
No, I haven't got a clue. But there was a cafe which was always open, you know, said hot steaks, meals and things like something like a McDonald's type of thing, you know, where we always used to, the bus used to go from there, and we always used to disembark there and get back on again there, you know, last bus back to camp. But quite a few of the lads had gone there, but that's the only kind of efforts I'd had, you know, in Pretoria, so.
Did you suffer any ill effects from the punch?
Yeah.
Yeah. How much did you weigh at that time?
I would think I was up close to the 10 stone limit. Well, I used to box at 10 stone 7. 10 stone, 10 stone 7. For Northern Counties before I went in the forces. You know. So I'd be about the same. Funnily enough, I've never put on much weight anyway. I think right up to the time of my packing up smoking, I think I was around the 10, 7, 11 stone mark, and I stayed level all the way through.
Is this called welterweight?
Yeah. I put on weight now, though, unfortunately, especially around the middle.
Any other incidents that happened to you in South Africa that you remember?